It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're catching up on our sleep news and research with Dr. Eric Dykin of the University of Iowa, where he's neurologist and a director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We like to have him on a few times a year at key times and to review some of the latest research in an area where, well, we hopefully spend about a third of our lives, because that makes the other two-thirds of our day really, really nice. If we don't, we have a sleep disorder, and it can make us feel pretty crummy. Dr. Dykin, welcome to our program once again.
Hello.
Research we'll be looking at in a little bit. We also want to field your calls, your questions as well. We'll be looking at a study that has now identified a night owl gene variant. Also, some research that shows we dream even outside of so-called REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. New NASA research on sleeping in space, where you can, if you were, for instance, in the International Space Station, experience 16 sunrises in a day. That would be something.
Yeah, I love sunrise.
You have to eat 16 cups, drink 16 cups of coffee. That would not be something.
Maybe not. Yeah.
Also, we'll talk about some sleep apnea. The Supreme Court deciding not to hear about a truck driver's appeal against a lower court decision. This trucking company evidently has the right to screen certain drivers for obstructive sleep apnea. Plenty to talk about this hour. We'd like to have your questions. Share your sleep problem, your unusual sleep experience this hour. Get advice from Dr. Dykin. Perhaps you have found a remedy for a long-time problem. You've solved it yourself or got a doctor to suggest something. It worked. Tell us about that, too. What have you changed in your life that has led to better sleep? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And let's start off with this study from Northwestern University. We know as we age, our quality of sleep generally declines. Researchers believe that this may contribute to later life memory loss. Well, this new research suggests there may be a simple solution to this problem, something called pink noise. Researchers at Northwestern University found that when they synced pink noise to the brain waves of older adults as they slept, the sound not only enhanced their quality of deep sleep, but it also improved their memory. These are recently published findings in the journal Frontiers in Human Neuroscience. You're saying, what is pink noise? Okay, let's, Dr. Dykin, let's have a little review of our noise colors. Mm. Okay, shall we?
Yes.
We know the best known of the noises is white noise, right? Mm. So let's hear a little bit of white noise right now. Okay, there we are. That's like old-time television. They turned off their signal. It's past midnight. You probably better go to bed. That's
right.
That's just fuzz on the TV. Okay, let's hear. Well, let's ramp up to pink noise. So let's hear something called brown noise before we hear pink noise. This is brown noise. Okay, a little bit bassier.
I can see the smoke rising from the fire.
Okay. Now center stage. Our main attraction is pink noise. Here's pink noise. Hey, you're dozing off.
That's just so much better.
Okay. Not a heck of a lot of difference, as you can tell. One's a little, yeah. Brown noise is a little bassy or something like that. So what do you make of this research, Dr. Dykin?
Well, yeah, and I think they parallel that pink noise with, like, the waves on the ocean or something like that. And it's really run by a good friend of ours, Phyllis Z, who's a good buddy. And what they've done is they've synced the sound, this pink noise, and they've probably tried a lot of other sounds, you know, in the past, finding that this works best with sleep stages in elderly patients. And they've compared memory tests before and after. And if you are given a memory task before sleep and then you're tested immediately after, you do better. Sleep helps encode memories. But if you have the addition of this pink noise in elderly patients, you sleep even better, more deep delta sleep, which is in our scientific based literature, the best, deepest, refreshing stage of sleep, and your memory is better. As we get older, our memory tends to slip, and wouldn't that be a nice addendum to having a longer life with more quality? So great promise for the future.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit more about how memory is connected to deep sleep. Why do we have better memory when, and we know we feel crummy if we don't get really good sleep? We feel better. We can remember things better. But what's going on? What do we know about that?
Well, you know, and from animal studies, there's proteins that build up during the day, and if it gets too long in the day, they inhibit encoding of memory. When you go to sleep, oftentimes there's neuronal brain tissue that is restored, and it's allowed to maybe sink in, for example, memory from dream, recall it, and then encode it in specific parts of the brain. And one of the studies we're going to talk about in a little bit, they talk about the prefrontal area of the brain. And when it's stimulated, when you see it excited on imaging studies, fast imaging studies, in addition to the report of dream recall, dreams are often recalled even better. So these circuits are allowed to interact in deeper sleep to encode memory in the long run. And it's interesting. We've all had the great dream that we forgot. Well, maybe that part of the brain wasn't excited. And if you could have excited it, maybe you would have encoded it and done better on the test.
Does that explain why dreams are so fleeting, that you really have to concentrate to remember a dream?
Well, it's very interesting, yeah, because what you often do, and many people think, there's the sifting through of all the memories during the day, and you dump the bad stuff, and you encode the good stuff. And you might miss some of the good stuff sometime, but if you could get more of a control of that, you might encode even better. But if you don't get sleep, the encoding memory, especially for simple motor tasks, is right out.
Okay. Join our conversation, Dr. Eric Dyke, a neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. How has your sleep been? Share your sleep problem or your unusual sleep experience this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Get some advice. 1-866-780-9100. Well, let's talk about what you just referred to, some dreaming, some scientists pinpointing what they call the brain's hot zone that is activated when we dream. Research showing recently that we dream even outside of REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. My understanding of the articles, it goes against the previous consensus among sleep experts, neurologists, Dr. Dyken, that humans experience dreams only during REM sleep cycles. What do you make of this, that possibly outside of REM there are dreams?
Oh, we've always thought there's been dreams outside of REM sleep, but maybe not as good. So we know there's a stimulation, and from the lower part of the brain, we call it the pons, to the geniculate nucleus, which is in the thalamus, to the occipital lobe. The occipital lobe is the hot zone that he's talking about. So part of dream is usual visual, and that's the visual part of the brain. So when we record brain waves, we usually do the EEG. You're really recording far from the generator source. So actually, dream sleep may be occurring much earlier than the recordings we pick up on an electroencephalogram or an EEG. So you might have these processes low in the brain, active, even though you're not recording them. So that's a phenomena that we've alluded to for years. But this brings it a little bit more into the public's eye. And that's sort of neat. And they show that in the dreams in non-REM sleep, where you generally aren't expected to have dreams, they're not as well formed as the dreams in REM sleep. But they both excite this hot spot in the occipital lobe, the vision area of the brain. The ones that you tend to remember, though, not only excite, it's implied, the hot spot, the occipital lobe, but also an area of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. So it's implicit that the dreams you remember are exciting not only the back of the brain, the hot zone, the occipital lobe, the vision area, but also the memory encoding area in the prefrontal cortex. Sort of cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Dr. Eric Dyken is with us this entire hour. We're reviewing the new research into sleep disorders, also some sleep that happens to make it into the news. We're also fielding your calls. Share your sleep problem, your unusual sleep experience this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to William in Des Moines. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, William.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's your question? You having sleep issues?
I've had some issues sleeping over the years. call. And in the evening, I'll sit down at 8 or 8:30, and I just fall down to sleep. And there's occasionally when I feel like I'll get a really good night's sleep, that I just feel 100% different, but I can't trace it to anything particular.
Okay.
So I just wondered if I have a comment.
Okay, I think we got you, William. A very bad phone line, sorry to say, but I think we got most of it. Dr. Daikin, did you get the gist of that?
Well, I think what he indicated was he's probably sleepy and snores, and he can monitor a bad night or a good night, but there's no one-to-one correlation. But in men, especially middle-aged men, especially if we're overweight, if we snore and if we're sleepy, people worry about obstructive sleep apnea, relaxation of the tissues in the back of your throat when you go to sleep because all your muscles relax, so much that when you suck in, it's like a wet straw. One out of every five American adult has obstructive sleep apnea. So he went through this study. You went through this study, and they showed you didn't have sleep apnea. Well, if you didn't sleep very well that night, if you didn't sleep flat on your back, gravity tends to pull your airway closed. If you didn't get the deepest stage of sleep in regard to apnea, which is dream sleep, rapid eye movement sleep that we just talked about, where your muscles are really relaxed, sometimes you can get a false negative study. And sometimes repeating the study, flat on your back, making sure that you're following all the specific protocols to get a good study, again, a negative study can occur in a true apneic. Nevertheless, keep a good sleep diary. Try to sleep 7 to 9 hours of sleep every single night. Avoid central nervous system depressants before you go to sleep. Alcohol and sleep deprivation can both make apnea worse. And see a good healthcare professional, PA, MA, nurse practitioner, or your doctor.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you have a sleep area, your sleep center there. You have regularly people coming overnighting. They get fitted with, takes a half an hour perhaps to get all these electrodes on their head right, and they have a sleep in a very controlled environment. Do you ever have somebody say, "I'm getting terrible sleep," and you come in and there's no apnea, there's no cause that you can identify, and they still say they get crummy sleep?
Yeah, and there's literally 5,346,782,000 things that can give you crummy sleep. And that's where basic approach to medicine is history and physical exam. So you sit down with the patient, you talk about when they go to sleep, how long it takes them to go to sleep, how long they sleep, when they wake up, the quality of the sleep, how sleepy they are during the day. And then you look under the hood, a physical exam, look at the back of the throat and everything else. And you can often narrow it down to one major diagnosis with an appropriate treatment to improve the life of the individual.
Okay. Let's go to one of our callers. Let's go to Charles from Indianola. Charles, welcome to you. I think you're...
Hi, good morning.
Good afternoon. I think you're...
Good morning. Can you hear?
Yes, we can hear you, Charles.
I have a couple of questions.
Sure, go ahead.
Do people sleep better when they have, when they experience natural sounds like ocean, birds, running water?
Good.
And my second question is, did sleep evolve? Why do we need it? And is there a gene for sleep?
Okay. We'll be talking about a gene for a night owl in just a minute. Charles, thank you very much. We had pink noise there. Natural sounds. Of course, we have all kinds of sleep apps on our smartphones, our tablets that, you know, give us natural sounds, a rainforest or the ocean, sound of the ocean next to us. Well, what about that, Dr. Daikin?
Yeah, well, as Phyllis Z from Northwestern showed with the pink sound in older patient populations, it mimics the sound of the ocean waves. So in that study, they not only slept deeper, more refreshing stage of sleep, which we call slow wave sleep, they also had a parallel improvement in memory. So in some people, yes. And for some people, it's going to be Yesterday by the Beatles. And some people, it's going to be Tchaikovsky. And in some people, what is positively conditioned for sleep is variable from individual to individual. Is there a natural sound? Well, Phyllis Z's study suggests in some patient population, yes, there is. But it is very variable across patient to patient, which is more soporific or sleep-inducing, if you will. Mm. Now, we do know from sleep deprivation studies, Dr. Rechtstoff in the 1980s had a series of elegant studies that really bothered PETA because these animals died, and they were sleep-deprived rats for 16 to 20-some days. Without sleep, these animals died across the board, especially if they were deprived of REM, rapid eye movement, dreaming sleep. Their basal metabolic rates went up. Their core body temperatures went down. They ate ravenously, and they died, and they looked horrific. There is something restorative about sleep, and you can almost feel it and taste it. We've used sleep deprivation as torture in Guantanamo Bay. We all know that there's something about staying awake for a prolonged period of time that requires restoration. So simplistically, it appears sleep is required for life, just like air and food. There's something restorative in regard to memory encoding, as Phyllis Z shows, and sometimes you can parallel a better stage of sleep with sound or just good thoughts.
Okay. Ben from Des Moines has a question to follow up on our pink noise research. Hi, Ben from Des Moines.
Green, you guys were talking about the study.
Yes.
You guys were talking about the study with the pink noise.
Yes.
And how it applied to elderly individuals. I was wondering if it did the same with younger people, maybe in their 20s and 30s.
Good question, Ben. What about that,
Well,
Doc?
Actually, no one studied that. So, I mean, and if you would like to start that study, sleep research, for a variety of reasons, is a branch of medicine in its infancy, and so much has to be done and will be done. So it's very exciting. But as far as I know, no one's ever really looked at that. But I do have an anecdote, which is far from science. When we were going through Lamaze class 26 years ago, it's my daughter's 26th birthday today. Happy birthday, Jennifer. They were telling her, my wife, with the pain and discomfort associated with the joy of childbirth, relax. I was supposed to be a coach, quote unquote. That's very chauvinistic. But think of the running waves of the ocean and over and over and over. And one individual in the room, and I might embellish this a little bit, said, oh my God, this is terrible. This is terrible. Why? I was caught in hurricane so-and-so, and I lost a relative in that. And so the sounds of the ocean for one individual may be music and may be soporific, sleep-inducing. It may also be insomnia, sleep-disrupting for another individual. So there's a psychosocial concomitant
association.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We want to get back to the second question. Charles from Indianola had a fundamental question we've attacked in many ways over the years on this program. Why do we sleep? Why did we evolve to sleep? Are there creatures perhaps that don't sleep?
And there's really not been a well-documented element of creatures that don't sleep. Immobility may actually be the parallel of sleep in an insect, for example, in some insects. So we all need restoration. You cannot run 100% of the time. And so the idea is that it is a mandate for life, especially in mammals, and that it is a period for restoration. And in fact, Dr. Bloomberg here at the University of Iowa is doing research on fetal young developing rats, and there is indication that in REM, rapid eye movement, dreaming sleep, that there may actually be neuronal restoration capabilities in individuals with stroke, heart disease, spinal cord injuries. So there is something that could be tapped into with the beauty of this restorative state.
Mm-hmm. And we know also from past studies of animals, we've talked about it on this program, because all animals need sleep doesn't mean we all sleep in the same way. We talked about frigate birds not too long ago, these long flight birds that fly for hours and hours, and they can actually turn off part of their brain?
Half brain, off brain.
They can turn off their brain. Part of their brain can go to sleep, and they can continue flying over the ocean.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting stuff. Let's go to this quickly. If you're a morning lark or a night owl, a study has now identified a night owl gene variant. Researchers at the Rockefeller University have discovered that a variant of the gene CRY1 slows the circadian clock. This is our inner clock. We've talked about a lot on this program that normally dictates when you feel sleep each night, when you're ready to wake. Explain what you see here, Doc.
Well, this CRY1 gene, it suppresses the biologic clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, this part of the brain of the hypothalamus that keeps us nighttime sleepers for the most part, and daytime wakers. And generally, we're about 24-hour animals. But when this CRY1 gene is really active, it suppresses the tendency to want to go to sleep early in the night. So the more active it is, the later you stay up. And the more sleep you have to get in the morning and the later you wake up. And we call that a delayed phase syndrome. And it often parallels young adolescents, young adults. They tend to stay up later and they tend to sleep in more. My son is the epitome of that. And he's got two finals today. And then he's got a final tomorrow after 10 o'clock final at 7 in the morning. He is going to be dead tired because he is wired as a sleep delayed phase. He is a night owl. So he's pretty good at staying up later. But in regard to this test, he is genetically at a disadvantage early in the morning.
Does that surprise you that they've we found a gene variant for night owl sleepers?
Oh, no.
There's a gene for everything.
There's a gene for everybody.
Well, yeah. So does this tell us, though, that if you're genetically predisposed to be a night owl, there's not much you can do about it? You're just that way, or a lark, or a morning lark.
You can play with it. My people work every night. I'm on call tonight. And there are people who can adjust to the shift work. We're fighting Mother Nature. And you can do it with a combination of genetic tendencies. People who are night owls tend to be able to work shift, late shift, much better than morning larks, which is the converse of this. But sometimes you can use bright light therapy to fool the system, to make you think in the deepest, darkest part of your working night hour that you should be wide awake. And sometimes the judicious use of medications that replicate what is the normal sleeping hormone in the brain, melatonin. So there's a variety of things you can do.
Okay, we'll be back in just a minute more with Dr. Eric Daikin of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center, entertaining your sleep problems and unusual sleep experiences this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Back with more of Dr. Eric Daikin on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer in just a moment.
I need some sleep. It can't go on like this. I tried counting sheep, but there's one I always miss. Everyone says I'm getting down too low. Everyone says you just gotta let it go. You just gotta let it go. You just gotta let it go.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, advances in technology and science might give you the impression we have mastered the universe. Actually, though, according to the authors I'll have on tomorrow, humans are still pretty clueless when it comes to fundamental questions such as, what is the universe made of? How many dimensions are there? And something like, what is time? That sort of question. Tomorrow, the authors of a new book, We Have No Idea. That's the title. We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe. Physicist Daniel Whiteson and Jorge Cham, he's the creator of PhD Comics. He's also a robotics engineer. Tomorrow on this program, what we don't know about the universe. It'll be a fun and informative program tomorrow, as is today. Sleep news and research with Dr. Eric Daikin of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He's a neurologist there, director of the Sleep Disorders Center. We're entertaining your sleep problems. We know sleep problems are not entertaining. I'm just using that as a verb, I guess. Probably should stop. perhaps you've changed something in your life that's led to better sleep. I've had bad sleep. It's nothing to joke around we'll look at some more sleep research also this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about sleep apnea in the news. Not too long ago, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear a truck driver's appeal against a lower court decision that found a trucking company had the right to screen certain drivers for obstructive sleep apnea, what you talked about in the first half hour. This is one of your main focuses there at the sleep clinic. Apnea is a big thing. So they declined. That means the lower court's ruling will stand. So it suggests that the trucking company may consider putting in place similar apnea screening programs without the fear of lawsuits, because the lawsuit here was brought. They said, well, it violates the American with Disabilities Act. And evidently, trucking companies can, they're allowed to screen drivers for sleep apnea. What do you get out of this ruling?
Well, I've got obstructive sleep apnea. One in every five adult in the United States has obstructive sleep apnea. I'm blind in my right eye because of obstructive sleep apnea. Untreated sleep apnea leads to a higher risk for heart disease, ischemic stroke, the number two cause of death in the world, and hypertension, which is a risk factor for the number one cause of death in the world, myocardial infarction. But one of the biggest complaints in a person with sleep apnea is pathologic sleepiness. Now, Dr. David Dingus at the University of Pennsylvania, who is a consultant for NASA, for the military, and the DOT, indicates we have the safest truck drivers in the world in the United States because they've been picked on because if they fall asleep, and the old data many years ago, behind the wheel of a 40-ton rig, 4.2 people go to the grave with you. Now, that's been changed because of improved safety with our truck drivers. So if a truck driver falls asleep behind the wheel, more than one person dies. But it's tremendously reduced because of the safety implementations that have been introduced. Sure, they're a pain in the rear end for the truckers, et cetera, but they are the safest because they get screened more than you and I are for disorders which might cause sleepiness like apnea.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a new device. I don't have anything other than a note about a new device, an implant that may be, well, sleep apnea now has the mask that you wear. And some that suits, some people don't find it so great. This may be a new device or an implant.
Well, we're doing it here at the University of Iowa. Dr. Van Dale from Otolaryngology, in conjunction with us, and Mr. Lee is the representative from Inspire, which is the only group, I think, that is now doing this device. It's a hypoglossal nerve stimulator. And there may be a subpopulation of patients who have a body mass index below 32 and a certain severity of sleep apnea, who this device, which is implanted under the skin that you press at night, that stimulates the hypoglossal nerve, which goes to the hypoglossal muscle, the tongue, pushes it forward when you go to sleep at night, opens up your throat enough to reduce the severity of apnea. Works in about 66% of the patients who are candidates for it. And my thought is, who wants something stuck under the skin? Well, what if you can't put a CPAP mask on your head? You can't use your arms very well. You've had an injury and you have paresis or limited mobility. If all you had to do was press the button, it might reduce the risks that I talked about with untreated sleep apnea.
So this is implanted once under the skin, where?
Under your skin, almost like a pacemaker on your chest.
On your chest.
Uh-huh. And you press that button, and there's a nerve that goes right under your jaw and right under the muscle, right? Well, you can't really see that, can you? But under the jaw, they implant it to the hypoglossal nerve, and you press the button only at night.
And the button's on your chest, or it is on a different device?
It's underneath the skin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right on the chest. And boom, you press that, and bloop. Your tongue goes forward and opens up what we call the anterior airway space. Now, you can do something similar with an oral device, but what if you can't manipulate well with your hands to put an oral device or a CPAP mask on your head? This may be an option for some people with untreated sleep apnea.
That's fascinating. Dr. Eric Dykin is with us, if you just joined us, of the director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We'll try to get to as many of your questions, your comments as we can before the end of the hour. Henry tweeted a while back, a few minutes ago. Henry wants to know, are there benefits to hard surface sleeping? No soft mattress, he says. Maybe just a thin bedroll. Henry tweets, I've been sleeping like this for years. We'll assume that he's not a teenager anymore, maybe not in his 20s. I don't know. Can you do that your whole life long, very thin bedroll?
It is a matter of fact that this is good for Henry. And it really works for Henry. And when I went with my mentor, Dr. Yamada, to visit his mom in Japan many years ago, we were on the hard roll. This is the way everyone slept, and it was preferable. I just went to sleep at my father-in-law's house in Louisville, and there's a great big indentation, just like his body, and you sink into the middle of it, and it's so soft. Oh, my God, did I love that. It's a variable thing. What works for you works for you. And in some people, a hard surface is better. In some people, a soft surface is – it's like that posture
pedic. Well, you know right away if you say, okay, I want to try out a harder surface with just a thin bedroll, does it take some getting used to? I would assume it does.
Oh, then my wife's bed at home where she slept in high school, it took all night for me to wake up and go, oh, my God, my back is killing me. No, I think you adapt to certain things. It'll take you a while to find out what works over the long haul. But there are different pressures, and you've seen the advertisements for the different beds that can adjust the pressure, to fit the dog, to fit the husband, then to fit the wife.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our phones. Cole is joining us from Redfield. Cole, welcome to our program. Cole, are you there? Okay, Cole's left us. Let's go to Crystal from, is it Dow's? Crystal, are you there?
Hi there.
Hi there. We can hear you. Great. Share your sleep problem or your question, please. Welcome to the program. Crystal.
This is Crystal.
Crystal, you're not hearing me. Okay, I think we're having some phone problems. Sorry. The note I see from Crystal, perhaps you can comment without hearing from her. A cranial cervical instability connected with sleep problems is the note I have on my screen about Crystal. Can you tell us what that's about, perhaps?
Well, you know, there's
my question is about cranial cervical instability. And as people who experience cranial cervical instability have a worse time sleeping.
Okay, thank you, Crystal.
All righty. Well, cranial cervical, it relates to a few things. If you got severe pain because of it, well, that's sure going to interfere with your sleep, pain anywhere in your body. But there are a couple of cases, for example, Down syndrome, which is near and dear to our heart, highly associated with obstructive sleep apnea, has instability at that area. Peter Dinklage, I think that's how you say his name, on Game of Thrones, achondroplastic. Those children, when they are first born, we do an immediate sleep study because that instability can cause compression of the brainstem, the lower part of the brain, where all the respiratory centers. And when they go to sleep, they may have obstructive apnea or central apnea. This little itty-bitty baby, what's the therapy of choice? Immediate pediatric neurosurgeon, and you can dislodge the pressure on that. The great Christopher Reeves, Superman, he had an injury at that area. He was improving with therapy, but he had to be on a respirator for almost 24 hours because of this. Oh, yes, the pain and the potential compression and changes at the breathing centers can put you at higher risk for sleep problems.
Finishing up with the last 10 or so minutes with Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorder Center.
Oh,
at the
let me add one thing for her, Crystal.
Ahead.
And if this is a board question, what you need if there's that instability is an MRI of your brain and brainstem. Make sure it is not compressed. Sorry, I wanted to make sure I added that in case she's taking the boards.
I hope you heard that, Crystal. Thanks for tuning in, for calling. We're having a little bit of problems with our phones. Hope to clear those up by the next program. But let's talk about some more research in the news having to do with sleep. Sleep in space. On Earth, we've talked about it many times. Of course, daylight regulating our inner clocks, our circadian clocks. When the sun rises and sunset, Dr. Dykin, you talked about the importance of getting like the early morning light, that spectrum, to sort of sync up our clock. Now, well, let's think of the astronauts, some aboard the International Space Station. They orbit the Earth every 90 minutes. If you do the math on that, crew members can see 16 sunrises every day. So a lot of disrupted sleep among our astronauts up there on the International Space Station. They've been doing some studies trying to find out how different light spectra and intensities lead to a better night's sleep. What do you see in this research, Dr. Dykin?
Well, and there are two things that make us want to go to sleep. There are the zeitgebers, the time cues that affect our biological clock through our eyes. The sun is the number one zeitgeber. So that bright light goes through the eyes and to the center, the biologic clock, to help you keep awake. When it gets dark, melatonin starts to rise. We've all heard that term. And you naturally get sleepy. But if it's occurring 16 times, your body's going to be crazy. And we're about 24-hour animals, no matter what happens on the shuttle. So you're fighting Mother Nature in some regard there. But you have a second system. It's the homeostatic. So there are things that build up over a 24-hour period. ATP is broken down, adenosine. The more this builds up, it goes to the basal forebrain, makes you sleepy. So there are two competing things. But if we can adjust the severity of life or the intensity, a certain degree of lux light, that's the intensity of light, if it's too high or too low, may actually disrupt the sleep more in an astronaut than less. So I would suppose they would downregulate certain periods of time to parallel a 16-hour day and then play off the homeostatic system. So I see great future for the results we get with varying the light and the timing of the light with our astronauts.
Our astronauts, because it's out of necessity. We want them to work effectively, productively,
right,
when they're awake. It wouldn't be the first time that we've benefited from research in space. There's a long list of things that space research then turns out to be, well, what comes to mind?
Osteoporosis and bone calcification, you know, without gravity. You know, they,
what about,
I think they're high risk.
What about Velcro? Velcro, Teflon, and something you drink every morning, Tang.
Oh, yeah.
That has its origins in space, going way back to John Glenn, I believe.
The more important thing is Tang.
I haven't had that for years. Let's go back to, well, our phones aren't working, but John from Norwalk, he called and left a message. He'd like to ask you to talk about lucid dreaming and whether it actually works. Now, lucid dreaming is, it's happened to most people, where you were aware that you were dreaming. But you can somehow stay in the dream for whatever period of time. Some lucid dreamers can actually work through intentions in their dream, do things in their dream while they're dreaming. Did I sort of get the gist of lucid dreaming?
Yeah. So one of my students, Tahir Bahati, I hope he's out there somewhere, he was trained to be a lucid dreamer at the Stanford Sleep Labs, which are like the number one sleep labs. They're really rock stars of sleep medicine out there. So you may have more of a tendency genetically to be able to do lucid dreaming, but he was actually trained to be a lucid dreamer. And you can control your dreams, like fly and do things, and that is just too cool.
Right. Susie tweets us, she's listening now to the program, about sleeping and memories. Susie tweets, I had two babies in 15 months and have forgotten much of those early days. Is that common? She's referring to the fact that I think she was you would be sleep deprived with two babies in 15 months, wouldn't you? So she's forgotten much of the early days of her babies because she was sleep deprived?
Oh, and probably so. Even during pregnancy, the first trimester and the last trimester, ask anyone who's been pregnant, they are difficult times to sleep. And then you have the baby. Trying to sleep with a baby that's up all night, and if you're breastfeeding, et cetera, and babies are ultradian. They sleep 4 or 5 or 6 total sleep-wake cycles in a 24-hour period.
Give me that term again.
Ultradian.
Ultradian. Sounds like a Star Trek term.
Yeah. So we are up all day and we sleep all night one time. They do that 4 or 5 times over a 24-hour period. So what's a mother to do? Because dad's, I can't breastfeed. So it's a very chauvinistic world. It is a tough time. So I would suppose sleep deprivation.
So tell Susie it's just perfectly natural. She's lost. She didn't get those memories encoded as you were talking about at the beginning of the hour.
The joys of parenthood. I hope my daughter's listening right now.
She's 26 today.
26. The joys of parenting. And they never end. But yeah, it's probably normal.
Right. Let's go up from babies here. We've got some research that it applies to toddlers. You know, there has been, Dr. Dyke, an explosion in touch screens in the home, down to the youngest set we have, also toddlers, babies even, understanding the impact they have on childhood development, these screens and tablets. We have yet to catch up on that, though. Here's a study in Scientific Reports showing that toddlers who spend time playing on smartphones. So if you have a toddler at home playing on a smartphone or a tablet, this study shows they seem to get slightly less sleep than those toddlers who do not play with these touchscreens, smartphones, and tablets. It suggests that every hour spent using a touchscreen each day was linked to 15 minutes less sleep. Now, they point out that there's an upside. Those playing with touchscreens seem to develop their fine motor skills more quickly. But this is pretty significant, isn't it? Taking sleep time away from toddlers by giving them touch screens? How worried should we be about this, Dr. Dyke?
And I think one of the people analyzed the results of this data, and I love the quote, he says, I wouldn't lose any sleep over this. Because he said in this study, the average sleep deprivation was about 25 minutes playing. They were playing about 25 minutes on the touch screen. Not only did it improve their fine motor skills, it resulted in only 6 minutes less sleep in their total sleep time, which was generally 10 to 12 hours. So he said, you know, you can overworry, you can underworry. My thought is there are times, though, with our teenagers and you and me, there's a blue light emitted sometimes. It may induce a reduction of melatonin. It may keep you up and excited at night and sleepy during the day. So don't text while you're driving either. But this study, this is probably okay.
Okay. Not too much to worry about, at least so far, until we get some more results. You mentioned blue light. Kelsey writing us, I had a friend who gave me a set of glasses that block out blue light. The world really looks weird on them when I wear them. Does research find that blocking blue light actually works like that? Does it affect sleep?
Yeah. In fact, we were talking about what they might do with NASA. Now, if you're really sleep deprived and you're working the night shift, you can use a blue light spectrum. And we use about 5,000 to 10,000 lux. And there's something like 420 nanometers or something like that. But it's safer for the retina, so you don't burn out your retina like staring at the sunlight, ultraviolet waves. But it can decrease the melatonin release when you're really, really sleepy and fool the system. And we often use this as therapy for pathologic sleepy people with circadian 24-hour rhythm disorders, maybe NASA astronauts. So yeah, if you're looking at a computer screen late at night and it's decreasing your melatonin because it's acting like the sun, yeah, blocking that out, there is evidence that can be therapeutic and also harmful in regard to getting a good night of sleep.
Okay. Cole from Redfield leaves these words, his question. We have just a couple minutes left, Dr. Daikin. Cole writes, I have Parkinson's disease and have trouble sleeping. Does Dr. Daikin have any suggestions for a good night's sleep? Parkinson's disease, a degenerative neurological disease?
Yeah, and it is the poster child for sleep disorders in neurology. There is a general neuronal degeneration of the sleeping centers, the waking centers. You're at higher risk for what we call REM behavior disorder, where you can act out your dreams, hurt yourself and others. There's a lot of problems with movement and jerking at night, and maybe even a higher risk of obstructive sleep apnea. So we start out with all therapy for all sleep disorders with cognitive behavioral therapy. That is essentially good sleep hygiene, stimulus control, make your sleep environment inviting, and go to bed only at night and wake up only in the morning, regular bedtime awakening times. Progressive relaxation therapy. If you have negative thoughts, cool out. Bedroom is only for sleep. And again, cognitive therapy. Know that 7 to 9 hours is pretty good for you, but you don't have to oversleep or undersleep. So good sleep hygiene is the first way to start. But if you're snoring like a banshee, rule out your sleep apnea. If you're having violent behaviors at night, rule out REM behavior disorder. And then see your doctor, your nurse practitioner, your PA, MA, get the full history. Get the full examination, then focus on a variety of differential problems that may be causing the problem and focus on one at a time.
We've got about a minute left. We talk a lot about light and its effect on our brains and our sleep on this program, Dr. Daikin. Now we're reaching longer and longer days until near the end of June we'll have that. Do you have people with fewer sleep disorders when we get these nice long days so that their brains can soak up the light as opposed to deep, dark winters?
It sure seems so. Seasonal affect disorder is really common, especially with less exposure to light in the winter. And oftentimes weight gain, often in young women, is the classic things where they eat more, they sleep more, and they can be severely depressed. So, yeah, enjoy the bright light. It tends to be a good thing, but still try to get your 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night.
Dr. Eric Daikin is neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Always so good to have you with us, Dr. Daikin.
Yeah.
Thanks for stopping in.
Thanks for having me.
River to River is produced by Chelsea Hoy, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Tomorrow on this program, the authors of We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe, physicist Daniel Whiteson, and Jorge Cham. He's the creator of PhD Comics. He's also a robotics engineer. We're going to be talking about things we don't know about the universe. Actually, humans are pretty clueless, they say. We'll find out what we can learn from that tomorrow on this program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.